Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday, the 5th of December. Very nice to have you with us. We are delighted to have you in our company, to be in your company, to be together. I'm speaking through a mask, so if I sound muffled, or as we, or as many of you will think, if you sound normal, just trying to keep everybody safe and happy. Although I was just talking to Judith about this, I said, I was told it was viral. She's wearing her mask anyway. I don't blame you. I am too. I also told one of our guests that it would be nice if they could sit closer to me. And very hesitantly, she said, okay. But good morning, all. Welcome. It's a delight to be here. I am thankful you are all here. We have a lot to talk about. So let's get going with all of the introductions, and then we'll talk about what is happening in this world of ours. A senior fellow and faculty member in the Center for Advancement of Public Action at Bennington College, president of Beyond Plastics, former EPA regional administrator, and co-author of the brand new book out this week. Woo-hoo. It's shimmering, it's shining, it's being reviewed positively and jubilantly across the board, including on Marketplace. The name of the book, The Problem with Plastic. Judith Enck, good morning. Congratulations. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you, Joe. It's been a fun week. The book came out on Tuesday, and my first interview was with you, which ran on Tuesday. Thank you. That was fun. Lots of my friends said they heard the interview and wanted to know how I could be in so many places on the same day. And I said, pre-tape. But the book's doing well. I will be at Oblong Books, a big WAMC supporter, on January 22nd.
In Rhinebeck?
Rhinebeck stores, yep. 6 o'clock. And New York Writers Institute on April 20th. I've done a bunch of interviews this week. I'm tired of hearing my own voice. I'm proud of the book. The cover is plastic-free. And what I've learned about, which is rare, most books have like a little plastic.
A little Mylar.
Not ours. And what I am excited about is pre-sales are going well. And I've learned in publishing, if you have a high pre-sale number, then the big book buyers will buy more. And pre-sales includes all this week. So if you're looking for a good holiday gift, please purchase The Problem with Plastic this week, and it'll count toward our pre-sale number. And one of the funny ironies about this book is we take a couple swipes at Amazon, and when I'm promoting the book, I urge everyone to buy it from the bookhouse, Oblong Books,
independent
bookstores,
bookshop.org.
Bookshop.org if you want to buy online. And ironically, every month, Amazon picks 8 or 9 nonfiction books as the books of the month, and Amazon picked The Problem with Plastic for December. So hopefully they've not read the book.
Well, I think they're...
The algorithm hasn't read the book.
I think the devil is calling you into the waiting room. But it's very nice. Congratulations all the way around. It's terrific. Again, the name of the new book is The Problem with Plastic, and Judith Enck is co-author
with Adam Mahoney.
And great stuff. So good material there. I was reading, you sent there was a piece that was, I mentioned the Marketplace piece with Guy Risdahl, and there was what was the percentage of plastic post-2007?
Well, 5 to 6% of plastics are recycled. What was he asking me about 2007?
There was something about the amount of plastics that we're dealing with right now, like
was created.
90%
yes,
was created
since 2007. Yeah, it's a modern problem.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
it really
is
incredible.
Yeah,
I mean, you make the point in the book, which we talked about. And by the way, if you'd like to hear that interview, it's available online at wamc.org. But you make the point that, of course, it's been around since
after World War II. Right.
But really, in the short term, it has been has created quite a problem.
And that's because of the glut of fracked gas on the market. And I will add, it's very hard to match the energy level of Kai Ryssdal when he's interviewing you. That is, he's really nice and he's really high energy.
Oh, that's cool. And he sounds just like the guy he briefly replaced, David
Brancaccio.
Yeah. David Brancaccio. But an excellent journalist. Wonderful. We welcome Sienna Freeman-Tolbert to the program, partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hannah. Good morning, Sienna. How are you?
I'm good. I'm happy to be here.
Wonderful to have you here. Anything on your mind?
Nope. No, not at all.
Okay.
I have a very simple practice.
Okay. Well, we'll get... I'm sure.
That's not what you were saying off air.
Or as we like to say, off the record.
Yeah.
That's
right. We also welcome the Siena University Professor of Economics, Aaron Pasidi, is with us. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. I don't have anything to promote, but I do want to say that...
I want you all to have books next time.
Yeah, I know. I really got to up my game. But last night, to celebrate the first snowfall and the full moon, Allison and I and some friends went on a nice late night full moon snowshoe cross-country ski adventure in our neighborhood. So for any of our neighbors who were seeing like footprints and ski trails through their front and backyards, that was us.
It was one of those times where it's just absolutely beautiful because you, I thought, oh, I've left a light on. And
yeah.
Then you realize that it's just daytime outside.
When the moon casts shadows,
it's just
so
gorgeous.
Yeah.
Yes. And then I saw these two people trekking across our field and I said, oh, it must be Aaron.
We didn't go that far.
You could have. You're always
well, next time we'll make sure to do that.
You have two guests with us. And before I go into a coughing fit, why don't you introduce them to us?
To my right, we have Jack Riley, who's an econ major and a math minor. So,
hi, Jack.
Hello, Jack.
How are you?
Hi, I'm good, thanks.
So what is what year are you in?
I'm a senior.
All right, and then what? What happens next?
I'm not sure. I'm looking at opportunities right now and also thinking about applying for grad school.
Oh, good, 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 good. And would you do that at Siena or somewhere else?
Looking at somewhere else.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll go spread the wings a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
And what piqued your curiosity if there were things right now that you're sort of tangentially interested in?
Yeah, I'm really, ever since I started Siena, I got really interested in macroeconomics and public policy. So I think doing something like that, even if it's not the first job I get, going into something like that would be really interesting to me.
Jack, we welcome you. We thank you, and I should have mentioned this, but Aaron has been bringing us students from Siena University over the past several weeks. I feel as though we've won the lottery. Just wonderful, smart, incredibly engaged young people to be with us and to talk about their ideas on the issues that we're discussing, and it's a real thrill to have them here. And again, I think we all benefit, and I thank obviously Aaron and all of the students and the university who has been so good to us. We also are pleased to welcome Sophia Tagliafiero. Did I get that right?
Yes, you did.
All right, excellent. As I told you, I practiced last night. tell me about your story. Are you what year?
I'm a senior, so I'm actually graduating this December, though. So,
well, it is December.
Yeah,
and I discovered she pulled a fast one on me. I did not know until this morning that she actually is not an econ major or an econ minor. She's just slid into all of my classes and has the capacity of an econ major or minor.
But actually an accounting major, so.
All right. Well, numbers are included, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So how much time do you have? Why are you... What do you have, like 5 days left?
Yeah, I actually only have one final presentation and then I'm done.
What are you doing here? Go out and enjoy the world, for God's sakes. So what's the plan?
So I'm currently working at a firm in Saratoga, Bucknam & Conley CPAs, and I'm actually working there later today. And,
all right.
And then I'm starting full-time with them in January.
You're not late for them?
I had to take some time off.
Do we have to write a note?
No, they're okay. They're flexible.
Excellent. And then we'll see what happens, right?
Yeah. Working in tax, working on getting my CPA.
Congratulations. So are you going to walk, as they say, in June?
Yes. Yeah, I want to.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Well, congratulations. It's so exciting.
You.
The journey is done. Did you do it in 4 years or was it 3.5?
So one semester early, so 3.5.
Oh,
yeah.
Good. Good for you. Well, that's wonderful news. We congratulate you heartily. It should be a wonderful holiday season, knowing that you have that at your back. We welcomed everybody, right? Everyone has been properly welcomed and introduced. And we thank you for being here as always. Let me go to stories for today. There are many. And I would like to begin, I think, with the story from the Supreme Court of the United States. I called it SCOTUS last week, and I got scolded by an audience member who said, "You keep on using these acronyms. And I don't know, and I don't understand. I don't know what a SCOTUS is, and I don't know what a POTUS is." And I said, "Well, it's Supreme Court of the United States, President of the United States."
Don't you watch The West Wing?
Well, that is exactly what I thought. And then I thought, well, before I watched The West Wing, I didn't really know about POTUS, mm-hmm. but here we are.
And then there's our current reality, Veep.
Right, exactly. So the Supreme Court of the United States clearing the way for Texas maps. We have been talking about this story on and off over the last several weeks, not just in Texas, although Texas is separate from the other gerrymandering redistricting efforts that are taking place. We talked about a story a few days ago about how this most impacts... one of the big impacts on all of this is the calendar, but here we now have the Texas officials had asked the court to allow the state to use the new maps in midterm elections, part of a push by President Trump to gain a partisan advantage. The Supreme Court cleared the way on Thursday for that to happen. The decision overturns, at least for now, a lower court ruling that the new maps were likely an unconstitutional racial gerrymander. That decision had blocked lawmakers from using the maps in the midterms. The Supreme Court's order comes days before December 8th deadline for candidates, that's 3 days away, to run for office in Texas. It marks a victory for Texas Republicans and for President Trump, who had pushed Republican-led states to revise their congressional maps to try to secure GOP victories in the midterms. This reporting from the New York Times. Judith.
So we no longer have separation of powers. You think the Supreme Court would be a check. The lower court had like 10 days of hearings and thousands of pages of documents and said, in fact, there were problems with racial inequity with the way the lines were drawn. And the three so-called liberal members of the court dissented. This does not bode well across the board, but also for other states like Indiana and states where there are trifecta Republicans in both houses of the legislature and sitting in the governor's office. You know, they will have free range now to do what Texas did. This, of course, is all designed to make sure that it's not fair elections in November for the midterms, which is all important. And it's a real slap in the face to civil rights, where lines are historically drawn to disempower people of color. And I'm always surprised when a court says, "Well, this wasn't racial discrimination. This was partisan politics, and that's okay. And that is the problem with gerrymandering."
Yeah. Yeah, I was just going to say very quickly, I think it's one of those things that's short-term pain and with long-term implications, but I don't think in the long term that the court is going to uphold this. But we're going to have this short-term pain, which is the midterm elections, is going to go in the favor. And because I was looking back into Allen v. Milligan. That was an Alabama case where 27% of the population was black, and Alabama redrew, gerrymandered. And when it got up to the Supreme Court and they did the actual reading and all of the casework, Justice Roberts and Justice Kavanaugh cited, it was a 5-4 decision, and they cited and they said, no, this is racial gerrymandering and that's not allowed. And that was just in 2023. So I hate to be this person. I am hopeful that maybe the court will get it right eventually, But no, they didn't get it right when it mattered. And that's what's the big deal right now. And so, you know, long term, maybe they will fix the maps. But short term, we're going to have a lot of pain from this decision. And I agree with you. This is political. This is political, yes.
Do we know when it comes to the political nature of it? I mean, so that makes the Supreme Court decision not a complete surprise.
Yes,
but then we start playing the numbers game of what the other states can bring together, as far as Democrats, Republicans, and so forth, and that all that fun and game stuff continues, right?
Exactly. I mean, this has just opened the door. Now all the states are going to start playing with their maps, and that's what we're going to see going into midterm elections. And it's just, there's always been gerrymandering. You know, we've always seen some of that, and it's always been protected to a certain extent by the Voting Rights Act. And, you know, racial gerrymandering has been a bright line rule, even for the Supreme Court, that it is not allowed. But now we're going to see kind of a race to change everything around, because what we do see happening consistently from the Supreme Court is they do not like these injunctions from the lower courts. They do not like this. They do not like the appeal. They don't like to deal with it. They like to see these cases on the merits. And so we're going to keep seeing this.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back and continue our conversation this morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Quick news break from the BBC, and we'll return to this discussion and your letters right after this.
The air is filling with leaves. There's ice on leaves. There's autumn retreat. The bones of the world reappear. Say, look at me. There's nothing to
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We are talking about the Supreme Court clearing the way for the Republican-friendly Texas voting maps. And as I said, we've been discussing this for a little while over the last several weeks. So this is the latest go-round in this particular story. We heard from a number of our panelists. Let's go to Aaron.
I want to echo something that Judith started off with, that, you know, it's very clear now that the Supreme Court's not the independent check on power that it used to be. But that's also part of Trump's playbook, is to take previously independent institutions and just make them an extension of the executive branch, whether it's the Department of Justice, whether it's the Supreme Court. And what's going to happen in May is that the next domino to fall is going to become the Federal Reserve. So he's going to install people who will essentially just do his bidding. So for anybody that thought that the Supreme Court continues to serve as an independent check on executive power, they can rest easy knowing that that's no longer the case. But in terms of the actual Texas bill and gerrymandering more broadly, normally in a democracy, we think that, you know, voters choose their leaders. This is how, you know, you go and vote. And with gerrymandering, it's the opposite. It's now leaders get to choose who their voters are going to be. Mm-hmm. And that upending of the normal democratic process essentially weakens or eliminates political competition, mm-hmm. so that politicians who are running know exactly who their voters are. Any competition is usually weak. And as anybody who, you know, knows the most basic things about economics, when you have a lack of competition, you get incredibly inefficient and inequitable outcomes. So inefficient, meaning the politicians who get elected aren't serving the interests of their voters. You're not getting debates on bills that might, you know, serve the public better. And from that, you get wildly inequitable results, where the bills that are passed serve the interests of the elites, the donor class, and it's just, you know, this is just intensifying and cascading. So I hope Sienna's right that this doesn't stand, and hopefully we see this getting peeled back over time. But it's just going to result in more political polarization where you have, you know, two sides that can't compromise on, you know, even agreeing on whether it's cold outside this morning, for example. And I mean, it's really just a travesty. But I also think if there's a silver lining to this, that it's that Republicans are nervous because their hold on power seems to be getting increasingly thin. Trump's approval rating is tanking. He's losing a lot of Hispanic, Black, and independent voters that, you know, voted for him in 2024. They are now becoming very, very disapproving of the policies he's enacted. So one way to look at this is that it's Republicans saying, well, we can't win by proposing policies that appeal to the public and might make their lives better. We have to rig the system so that we can have power to impose all of these draconian policies on the rest of the population.
If there is good news here, Judith Enck, it seems to be that even in strongly Republican areas, and we see this slightly within the state of Tennessee this past week, that those districts that were solidly Republican are becoming more, at best, purple.
Yeah, and there is a backlash, as Aaron said, mostly against the immigration policies. You know, very few people disagree that if someone, in fact, is, a convicted felon and they're not here illegally, that that's a fair process. But people are appalled by innocent people, including children, being abducted by ICE. More and more people are appalled by these strikes on vessels, boats in the Caribbean and yesterday in the Pacific. And I don't think Trump is doing himself any favors by saying affordability is a Democratic hoax. So this is why we are seeing the enhanced gerrymandering. There's all sorts of things going on with voter rolls, with the federal government asking for secretaries of state to share voter rolls. I think the Republicans are setting up a very deliberative process to interfere with next November's elections because they know that they are losing public support, as evidence of the Tennessee results in a ruby red district that Trump won by 22 points, and I believe the Republican won by 8 or 9 points last week. There are a lot of Republican House members, including Mike Lawler in the lower Hudson Valley, who understandably are very nervous. And so I think we have to be clear-eyed about how Trump and his supporters will, in fact, try to rig the election.
When we look at this too, Sienna, as far as the courts go, this will not be the only court ruling on issues having to do with redistricting. And we're going to see this at the state level. We're going to see this throughout the country in other states besides Texas. We're already seeing it in California, obviously. So it'll be interesting, but as I mentioned earlier, there is this, the clock is ticking.
The clock is ticking. I mean, I think, you know, like I said, most of these cases on the merits may be successful, but the problem is this injunction issue that the Supreme Court has at the highest court is having with lower federal courts issuing injunctions and not liking these temporary injunctions that either impact nationally or impact locally. You know, we're seeing it in immigration a lot, and we're seeing a lot of pushback on that. And so, you know, the function of an injunction is to keep something the status quo until we can get to the merits of the case. And the fact that the Supreme Court is pushing back against something, because that's, at its essence, that's what this decision is about, right? It's like, no, let it go back, let it fully adjudicate. And they're saying we're going to allow it to roll through. It's scary for us, especially in the immigration world, where we need injunctions while we get to the merits of the case because it's impacting people today on what the policies of the administration. So we're watching this closely, but we are not hopeful when we see these kind of decisions coming out of the Supreme Court, which is, you know, our highest court of the land. We expect you to protect the people, and we're very disappointed, especially, you know, we're talking about voting here, but this also impacts the other areas of concerns such as immigration.
All right, let's go to Bruce, who writes this letter. I will not be at all surprised if the conservatives on the Supreme Court come up with some flimsy excuse to throw out the California redistricting plan. At this point, I see them as a bunch of partisan hacks who start with the outcome they want and then find some flimsy excuse to get that result. I assume you would not be as cynical, Sienna.
The audacity of hope. I would, based on this current decision, I would say it would be hard to argue that they could, you know, knock down California, but they could do it, and they would. And so I'm not surprised. I would not be surprised if they find a way to rule against the Californian laws. But based on the current precedent, my legal eye is saying, how? You're just gonna, you know, contradict yourself. But they've done it before, and they'll do it again.
Yeah. Anybody else want to get in on this particular discussion? All right, that is fine. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll go to another topic. We've got many, many of them, so we will do that. And we'll be back right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable for this Friday, the 5th of December. Very nice to have you with us. The music we were just hearing is from Winter Pills and their new album, This Is How We Dance. I told you this is how we dance. And this is how we dance. Great stuff. They're going to be playing the Park Theater in Hudson, New York tomorrow night. If you want to find out more information, you can go to winterpills.com. Please get that URL correct because it could bring you somewhere you don't want to be. winterpills.com, playlist posted online, wamc.org/roundtable. And we thank them for the great intro music, the bumper music into our segments this morning. Okay, I want to just touch on something.
And Joe, of course, like the youngest child that I am, I go to Winter Pills to see what happens when I put in the wrong thing.
Yeah.
I'm like, let me test this out.
Yeah, you never know. You never know. The federal, so I wanted to, speaking of Sienna, what I wanted to get to something you talked about of how these stories about voting rights in the court, obviously, also have ramifications when it comes to immigration, which brings us to another big story, which is the federal deployments that have swept through major cities as part of President Trump's immigration crackdown have led to thousands of arrests. The reporting in the New York Times this morning says they have been less effective at apprehending immigrants with a criminal record, which I think is what they were supposed to do.
Is exactly what they said they were going to
do. Okay. Then more routine operations elsewhere. In high-profile immigration and custom enforcement operations in Los Angeles, Chicago, Washington, D.C., and across Massachusetts, more than half of those arrested had no criminal record, compared with a third of immigrants arrested nationwide. If you do go to the New York Times story online, you will see a chart and a graph, which are very helpful in explaining these. But since they do me no good on the radio, You'll just have to hear me try to figure it out. The Trump administration has said that the aggressive operations are necessary because of so-called sanctuary city policies have made it harder for ICE agents to go after immigrants who have committed crimes. It has deployed other federal forces, including Border Patrol and the National Guard, to expand its crackdown. We've been hearing these stories. The operations have upended life for many residents and prompted protests and backlash. Local leaders say they have done little to make their cities any safer.
No. What you're seeing happening right now is ICE and the Department of Homeland Security trying to get their numbers up to show that they've detained a certain amount of individuals. And the way they're doing it is not by going after criminals. They're going into the local immigration benefits office and arresting people when they're there for their interviews, people who have pending employment authorizations, who are working legally for our small businesses and our companies around the country. They are going to the immigration court. They're right there in the hallways where people are there and seeing a judge and they are there for their case and they're adjudicating their case and they're picking them up and they're taking them and they're detaining them. What you're seeing is them rescinding a prior sensitive areas memorandum, which protected places like schools, hospitals, and religious institutions, and they are in those parking lots. You see them in a school parking lot on the way to people walking to school, picking people up. That's what you're seeing them in day-to-day life, picking individuals up, detaining them. We now have case law that states that if you entered the country without inspection, it is very hard for you to get a bond out. So we see these detention units popping up all over the country. They're makeshift. We have some down in Louisiana. Everyone's heard about alligator Alcatraz. When you're in places like that, it's hard for us to for them to reach legal counsel. It's hard for them to reach their families. It's hard for them for us to track them. What you're seeing also is individuals who may have counsel here, even in New York, they're being transferred very quickly to other parts of the country where we can't reach them or we don't know where they are. And it is almost like kidnapping because one day they're here, the next day they're gone, and then we have to find them. And one of the only ways to find a foreign national who's been detained by ICE is through their alien number. And a family member must know that alien number in order to find them. The ICE facilities are not picking up their phones. They're not responding. It is one of the hardest things to find someone once they're gone, unless that individual is able to call out. And that is not feasible in some of the newer facilities down south. And so we're just fighting the good fight.
Two things that strike me in what you just said. One is that this is very similar to the old story about the local cop who parks across the street from the bar and just waits for the people to walk out and then gets them on a DWI.
I support.
Well, yeah, I understand, but it is like getting fish, you know, shooting fish in a barrel. But in this case, you have just people like you're just walking in while they're working on the problem or a solution, and then you're taking action while that is happening and prior to it.
Yeah, because what we have is we have our Fourth Amendment rights, which protects you, which protects a lot of businesses. So they can't come into a business without having a warrant signed by a federal judge, not one of their administrative warrants. And so what they tend to do is they lurk in the parking lots, but what they can do is go into federal buildings. And so when someone has a hearing, they know they can stand around, ask about their status, they can get them as they come out. When someone goes into a federal building for their immigration benefit application, they know they can stand there and pick them up and get them out without any problems. And these aren't individuals who are coming in big, you know, once in a while you might see them in the ICE vest and they're coming on official matters and they're looking for some, you know, as the administration likes to call them, narco terrorists. These are individuals in their khakis, their sweatshirt, and their mask. They look regular. And so when they approach you and they're asking you questions, you don't know if it's a stranger off the street.
You just described my wardrobe today. Go ahead.
And you have the mask on.
Yeah, I know.
But seriously, people don't know who they are all the time and who's asking them these questions. And they're just walking up from a unmarked car. And it's very unsafe. It's very unsettling for the communities, and it's just brought a whole level of anxiety to anyone. anyone who's come to this country, whatever your status is, if you have an accent, if you look different, automatically you feel like you may be targeted by these individuals, and you don't know whether to stop for the random guy with the mask on and a khaki and a sweatshirt. Do I stop and comply because he's a federal officer, or is he some random off the street who's asking me questions? No one knows, and we're operating in this environment every day.
The other point I wanted to touch on in what you said is that there seems to be, that's what used to be a 6 degrees of separation, that so many of us now, I don't think many of us, certainly who live in this region, cannot name at least a couple of people that we know, or a situation that has involved people that we know, that where this has happened. It's not a one-off. It's not, you know, this is happening in Chicago, mm-hmm. this is happening in Charlotte. This is happening, as Judith pointed out during the break in an article from the Times Union, this is happening 5 doors down from us at the mosque here in Albany, where federal immigration agents arrested 10 Afghans this week as the federal government is rounding up migrants from that country following the shooting of the National Guard member. So and as far as we know, that's continuing.
Yes. The Times Union had an important article about arresting people from Afghanistan as they were at their house of worship, the mosque, just down a few doors down from WAMC on Central Avenue. And there are reports that ICE is circling today as we speak near the mosque, looking for people to pick up. As was pointed out during the break, the United States government previously had a policy not to arrest immigrants at houses of worship, schools, hospitals, and the Trump administration rescinded that in January. This is quite serious, and it's happening close to home. It's literally happening on the same block as WAMC in Albany, and it is not at all targeting people who have criminal records, as the Times points out.
I will say very briefly, these individuals more likely than not have pending asylum applications.
Yes, that is being reported.
If allowed to adjudicate, it'd probably be successful in the immigration court. However, what's going to happen is they may be detained and they will not be allowed to be released. And so when an individual is detained and not allowed to be released, they have further incentive to, you know, get out or self-deport, right? Because they're in these places where they don't want to be. They don't care that they don't have, they just want to get out of there. It's traumatic. Being in these places.
And what I've been reading about in the past week, and I wonder if you know about this, is they're also now picking up children.
Yeah, family detention centers. Yes, they are picking up. It's a lot more processing for them, but they will do it, no question.
I want to just key in the Times Union in their reporting, Emily Munson, the article that Judith referenced. Just read this. I'm going to read this paragraph. The men arrested Wednesday are part of a large family from Afghanistan that has resided in Albany for 2 years, according to their brother, who spoke to the Times Union, but requested their names be withheld to protect their safety. The stress of the arrest sent their mother to the hospital emergency room with heart issues on Wednesday. That idea of requesting their names be withheld to protect their safety, I mean, that's the whole.
Yeah.
No one is living free at this point.
No.
Because they I just think the bravery of then going to the next service, which would be today.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. The reason why they want to have their name withheld, which I would have recommended, is because we don't want them to be moved, right? ICE has the right to move you anywhere in the country. And ideally, you want to be somewhere where your family and friends can come and visit you. And in a blink of an eye, in a move of a pin, the ICE facility officer can move you from Buffalo all the way down to Florida, to Louisiana, move you to New Mexico, where your family may never be able to have the resources to see you again. So it's really serious.
So let me ask there's no way for me to ask this question without sounding cynical and sarcastic, but I'm going to ask it anyway. And that is, so they are saying that this is as a result of the National Guard shooting that took place the day before Thanksgiving in Washington, D.C., in which an Afghan national who had been given asylum by the Trump administration tragically shot and killed one National Guard officer and critically injured another, which is a heinous, horrible, disgusting crime. But they're using that as the reason for then taking this action in the city of Albany, New York. I assume that if it weren't what happened last week, it would be something else.
It would be some other reason, right? So in addition to them picking people up, they've also done other actions. They've issued a memorandum where anyone that's on the travel ban country, a restricted travel country, then you are no longer, they have paused all asylum applications. So they're not adjudicating asylum applications at all for them. Anyone from any of those countries, they are no longer giving them any immigration benefits. So that means they're canceling their interviews. And they say they're doing this under the guise that they need to perform enhanced security and vetting of these individuals now. And so everyone from those list of countries now have to undergo advanced security and vetting, even though they may have lived here in the U.S. for a significant amount of time.
Aaron?
So there's obviously the legal and humanitarian aspects about this, and some people might think that, okay, well, this doesn't apply to me. He's cleaning up the streets, even though the net the administration casts is so wide that they're just picking up anybody who's
not white.
Not white. Yeah. No. Thank you. I was trying to think about how to put that more delicately, but that's the correct way to say it.
No delicate way to put it, doesn't it?
But, you know, for all of those people who think that, well, this doesn't apply to me, he's cleaning up the streets, and if you have to sacrifice a couple of immigrants who are here legally and aren't doing anything bad, then, you know, so be it. There are going to be consequences of this that are going to affect the country more broadly. When, you know, the stated justification is, well, we're going after undocumented immigrants that have criminal records. And that's a tough thing to disagree with. But that's not,
it does kind of depend on the crime. Sometimes it's traffic violations.
Sure, right, exactly, right. Yeah, like there's a big difference between drug trafficking and, you know, murder charges then. But remember, so this is just part of the politics of fear that he's trying to instill, and only a strong man can save the country from this threat. But a lot of these immigrants who are being detained are, you know, who are here legally. They have pending asylum applications. These are people who are largely gainfully employed, right? It's they work in agriculture. They work in food processing. They work in construction. They work in leisure and hospitality. They own small businesses. They work in healthcare. They work in education. They work in information technology. When this starts to affect the economy more broadly, all of a sudden you're going to start to see a contraction in employment that leads to rising unemployment, that leads to lower spending. This is one of the many policies the Trump administration is passing that is slowly pushing the economy to what is very likely going to be a recession. And it's not going to be the ICE raids that do it in and of themselves. There's a variety of things, I mean, almost too many to list at this point, that are just acting as a headwind on growth. So when people think that, well, this doesn't apply to me, it will, because it's one of the dominoes that's going to fall, that's going to slow growth, decrease spending. You know, small business owners might not show up for work because they know they can be targeted there. You know, and remember, a lot of those business owners actually employ U.S. citizens. So when they don't go into work and people find themselves getting laid off because of that, or American citizen-owned businesses can't find workers to fill the jobs, there will be economic pain and cost to be suffered from that.
Don't worry. We'll talk more about economic pain in just a moment when we return. There's more on that, and we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. A great group this morning. We'll get back to our conversation after this top of the hour break and news. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Man, do we have a group. Judith Enck is here. She is the author of a brand new book called The Problem with Plastic. Woo-hoo. It came out on Tuesday, and is available at booksellers everywhere, especially our independent bookseller friends who would love to help you out and obtain a copy of The Problem with Plastic. Also, Sienna Freeman Tolbert is here, partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna. Siena University professor of economics Aaron Pasitti is here with two majors in that subject from Siena University, Sophia Tagliafiero and Jack Riley. And we welcome all to the program, and we thank you very much for being with us. All right, let's go to other things that are making news on this morning. We do have some letters that I would like to. So let me interrupt myself and just do a couple of these letters real quick. If anybody wants to jump in, please do. Otherwise, I'll rip through them quick. Lois says, I've been tutoring and working with documented asylum seekers from West Africa for 2 years in Albany. All these people have checked in per the law with ICE for 2 years. The difference in the past couple of weeks has been that check-ins lead to detainment. Mm-hmm. The number detained in New York State has greatly increased. They live in fear, although they've followed the laws of this country. I'm appalled at the state of inhumanity we are witnessing in regards to immigrants in the city, state, and the United States.
And you can't just think about the cost this is going to cost our country just to detain all these individuals who are nonviolent, who are in compliance, and we're just keeping them detained. And it feels like nothing but a quota system that they're trying to get numbers to say they have this many people detained, they've apprehended this amount of people.
But it has been interesting. Like, you know, we ask, what can we do as individuals, as like people who are not targeted by ICE? And it has been interesting to see what unfolded in Chicago, in Portland, where people show up with their own bodies in protest. And, you know, they're not having that huge force in Chicago. And in Chicago, I think it was border control.
Right.
Is that what they're called? Border control?
Yes, CBP, yeah.
Yeah, what a weird name. Rather than ICE. And we all have to do something. I mean, we get numb to this, but even if we're not immigration attorneys and immigration rights advocates, we all have to show up and defend our neighbors and our sisters and brothers and explain what people's rights are. Are these actually immigration agents? You know, do they have warrants to enter buildings? It's legal to videotape what you witness. And there are a lot of good resources out there. I think we've got to not leave this to immigrant rights specialists. We all have to do something. And, you know, we need our mayors and our elected officials standing arm in arm with the immigrant community when people are targeted.
And I will say, just if there is a silver lining, it's that people realize how much of a how integrated and how many foreign nationals they are in our country and how much they make up the fabric of our country. And you find them in ways you don't expect. They're in your higher education institutions. They're in your tech companies. They're everywhere.
Hospitals.
And they tend to be a quiet population, right? If they're legal, whether they have documents to work in a country legally, there's no need to know about their immigration status. It's their private business. But now we're seeing this and people are realizing how much of a part of the fabric they are of our country.
Is it your birthday today, Judith?
It was my birthday yesterday.
Aww. All right. Well, we're a day late, which I thought your birthday was in November. And the reason I thought that was because I went to a birthday party that was in November. It was right before I had my accident.
Oh, that's how you remember
that.
It.
Yeah,
that
that's
was
how
early
I remember
that
it.
Year because
yes.
We wanted to do it at that beautiful setting.
Yes,
in
it was
Pittstown.
Gorgeous. Absolutely beautiful.
Nip Moose.
Nip Moose.
Right.
And how do you not enjoy, how do you not have a blast at Nip Moose?
Exactly.
So happy birthday.
Thank
day
you.
Late,
yeah,
but
yeah,
thank you.
It was...
It's a pretty good birthday week to have a new book out and do all the stuff.
Yeah.
It's good.
My life seems to happen in little clusters. I remember when it was my birthday a number of years ago, and the same week I moved to New York City and started my job at the EPA. So this week, it was my birthday and my book. It was lovely.
Excellent. Well, congratulations. Happy birthday to you.
Thank
even,
you. How did you know it was my
birthday? A daylight. Oh, a letter writer informed me incorrectly.
Oh, great.
He told me it was today, but that's okay.
Must be a relative.
Yes. And Diane, does that make a ring
Diane,
a bell?
Diane, yes, my okay. dear neighbor.
Excellent.
Thanks, Diane.
All right. Vicky says, I just learned 10 minutes ago that a young woman in Syracuse gainfully employed in the Syracuse education program legally here in the United States under the Temporary Protective Status, TPS, program, received a letter of deportation and has a limited amount of weeks to leave the U.S. She's being sent to a South American country where mm-hmm. she has not lived for over a decade and from which she fled with validated safety concerns. Where is my America? Queries Vicky.
Almost all the countries that are under temporary protective status, including places like Venezuela, where we are saying there's all these narco terrorists, it's ended. And so all these individuals are now either being detained or they have to leave in a timely fashion. So we're seeing that all over the country right now.
Susan writes, President Trump has effectively raised his own military with his authority to snatch people away from their homes and families. He's already condoned the kidnapping, a felony, of American citizens, including children. ICE is funded more generously than American military on the taxpayers' till. The implications for our future is ominous. When anyone is targeted, who can continue to resist? Then we go to this letter from Barbara. What kind of Kool-Aid are they serving at these White House cabinet meetings? Watching each member get up to praise a man most of them had disparaged many times over is just plain nauseating. That from Barbara. Tone from me.
And sometimes the president doesn't get to hear the fawning over them because he's asleep.
A Marine veteran had his wife arrested by ICE at her final green card interview. This from Jared. This is the opposite of what Trump administration promised during the election. The disrespect of this veteran and his family is beyond belief. We then, I think that may be it for now for our letters. Okay, so we move on to other issues. Cue the economists. Private employers cut jobs in November, the latest sign of a slowdown. Data from ADP, a payroll processor, is getting added attention because of delays in official statistics caused by the government shutdown. When the flow of official data ran dry during the federal government shutdown, policymakers worried the drought would make it hard for them to know if the economy took a turn for the worse. Those fears may be becoming a reality. Private employment fell by 32,000 jobs last month, the payroll processing company ADP said on Wednesday. It was the third decline in 4 months, and taken at face value would be a clear sign that the labor market, after months of cooling, had entered a new, more worrying phase. This from the New York Times. But other sources have not shown the same kind of sharp decline, and more authoritative data isn't available because of the lingering effects of the shutdown. The November jobs report from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which was scheduled for release on Friday, has been delayed until December 16th, and the government is skipping the October report altogether. Data on inflation, spending, and production also delayed. Aaron Pasitti.
The unemployment rate and the employment situation that the Bureau of Labor Statistics releases on the first Friday of every month is arguably one of the most critical pieces of data that every bank, every financial firm, every policymaker, every politician, every business relies on, because it's timely. It's once a month. It presents a very broad indication of the overall strength of the job market and the economy, but also because it directly affects people's lives. It affects their ability to get a job, earn an income. So people rely on this. And the fact that the government shutdown delayed the reports and actually for the first time in over 70 years is not going to release a report for October could not come at a worse time, because the economy is at an inflection point. Trump's policies, the tariffs, the deportations, the budget busting, I'm not even going to say its name, the budget bill, the giant tax cut for the wealthy, and the savage cuts to Medicaid, letting the Affordable Care Act subsidies expire. All of these things are pushing the economy closer and closer to the edge. And when we go over that edge, it's very likely that we will end up in a recession. And Since Trump took office, the unemployment rate has gone from 4% to 4.4%. It's not a major increase, but certainly not moving in the correct direction or the direction we want to see. Inflation's gone up from 2.3% to 3%. So we're starting to see the price increases associated with the tariffs and the deportations. And while Trump can complain about, you know, the deep state and government officials are rigging the data because they don't like him, and, you know, you have all of these, you know, woke policymakers that are churning the stuff out, it's kind of tough to argue with a more boring but more important firm than ADP, who just mm-hmm. processes payroll for an enormous amount of private sector firms. So what ADP showed, which Joe alluded to, was a 32,000 person decrease in employment in November. So it's not just that their report over the past, you know, 11 months have been showing slowing job growth. Now we're starting to enter negative job growth territory. Yes, there are other sources like state and local government, Department of Labor, unemployment insurance claims. There are other surveys out there, but they're all showing the same thing, and that's a slowdown in labor market activity, which is symptomatic of just the policies that have been implemented. Tariffs being on, tariffs being off, tariffs being back on, tariffs being paused, picking fights with China, picking fights with Brazil. All of this creates enormous uncertainty for businesses. When you think about businesses that are making multi-million dollar investments that span, you know, years, like building a new apartment building. Okay, so you need concrete, you need steel, you need all of these things. Well, if you don't know what the price is going to be 2 years from now, let alone 2 months from now, most firms just put those projects on hold. So what you're seeing is a decline in business investment and business spending, and usually associated with that comes just businesses freezing hiring. And that's what we've seen. So this is not a good sign, but it's a perfectly predictable sign, and one that I've been, you know, banging the drum about since January, that if, you know, if these things happen, it's going to be a slow boil, not some catastrophic explosion in the economy, but a slow boil that is just marching us closer and closer to recession. So I'm curious to hear what my students who are, you know, both one who's entering the job market and fortunately has a job, and one who will be entering the job market soon. You know, think about this. You know, was there stuff in the report that suggests that Trump's policies are backfiring? What do you think, Sophia?
We saw the article highlighted manufacturing and professional service jobs as well. So, I think my career is considered a professional service job. So those white collar corporate jobs, and then we also see the AI scare is also significant too at this time. Like, that's definitely playing into my considerations about the job market. We see Amazon's large layoff because they're investing in AI technology. So that's weakening the labor market as well. So it's all just concerning, to say the least.
Jack? Yeah, I think it has a lot of just the uncertainty it causes with the regulations, the future of what the Fed might do with only a certain amount of information. I think it really doesn't go well for small businesses or really any businesses. And I think it's really just, as someone that's going to enter the job market, it's just really amazing to see. It just seems like the administration just doesn't care very much and is more focused on other issues like ICE than helping the economy out. It's just not. It's depressing.
I think it's so interesting that you guys mentioned the AI component because, you know, my older upper millennial brain, I didn't even think about how you might feel like you're competing with the AI for these, going into the market for these entry-level jobs that AI can purportedly perform in, you know, less than 3 seconds, you know, and if how does that impact your ability to find an entry level, not that you guys are entry level, but I'm saying how does that impact your ability to find an entry level position where you're growing and learning when you have AI, you know, doing all your spreadsheets for you in 2 seconds that, you know, would normally be someone inputting that data in or, you know, something like that. I wonder about that.
Yeah, go ahead.
I had a professor mention that to us because a lot of accounting work, when you start at these big firms, like, they're kind of taking a loss on you. You're learning all of these functions, and they expect you're not expected to have the skills at that time. You're expected to learn the skills at that time in these entry-level positions as an accounting firm. But AI is kind of taking those positions away, and it's more profitable for firms to use AI rather than hire a person, kind of take the loss on them and train them for those few years. So you have to be more skilled just entering the job market, and that's kind of the emphasis that I've seen in my professors, like, putting it on us. Like, you have to know more because AI took away those easy jobs that you could get. So you have to be more educated and more prepared.
Did you want to go ahead, Jack?
I was just going to say, I think it's going to be an interesting few years, because even if AI doesn't exactly take jobs, figuring out exactly what role it's going to play is also just a big concern.
Right, because we're sort of in the Wild West now.
Yeah.
And then figure out exactly what's going to happen and then deal with that.
And these AI centers are using a massive amount of energy and water. There are huge environmental implications that go with AI. Huge power plants are being constructed just to feed AI centers.
A lot of technological change that happened before.
Have I told you lately that I love you? Go ahead.
You know, a lot of technological change that happened before primarily replaced blue-collar work. The AI is different because now it's coming for white-collar work. And its ability to, you know, read and extract important information from legal documents, the ability for it to peruse the tax code to find, you know, different exemptions and things you can take advantage of, its ability to write code from prompts, that poses a much greater threat because, you know, white-collar workers tend to be wealthier, they tend to be educated, and when you find that all of a sudden technology is coming for your job, and whether it creates unemployment for those workers or just creates more insecurity or puts downward pressure on their income, all of a sudden you're going to start to see discontent amongst groups where you haven't seen discontent before, right? This isn't just, you know, robots and automation and the assembly line replacing, you know, auto workers. This is people replacing, or this is technology replacing computer science majors and accountants and, you know, entry-level lawyers and paralegals. It can come for academic jobs,
yeah,
too.
Right, right.
I could probably write a class that could be self-sufficient with enough time and energy where AI just can present information, respond to student questions. So it can come for academic job. I'm not singling you out. I'm just on the chopping block too. So it's like Sophia pointed out, the advantages will accrue to those who are capable of using it. So a sensible so when Jack was mentioning how depressing this report is and what these policies are doing, you would think a political administration that's concerned about making America great again and providing opportunity for groups that have been left behind over the past 40 years due to deindustrialization and offshoring might, instead of spending money on deporting immigrants, might spend that money on vocational training for people on how to use artificial intelligence, how to make it so that they become more productive members of the workforce that know how to use that. But instead, we're seeing the opposite, right? All he's doing is bowing down to the what I've seen referred to as the techno-crypto broligarchy of just, you know, implementing policies that benefit them and letting it run amok, and the rest of the population is just left to fend for themselves. Where's the vocational training? Where are the education subsidies that are going to help people deal with this rapidly changing environment? And they're just entirely absent.
I admittedly am probably trying to force a square peg into a round hole in this particular story, but it does strike me that the fact that the largest business story of the day is that Netflix has struck a deal with Warner Brothers Discovery, mm-hmm. this legacy Hollywood giant behind Friends and Harry Potter, to buy its studio and streaming businesses for $72 billion. The acquisition was announced this morning. It would bring two of the industry's biggest players in film and TV under one roof and alter the entertainment industry landscape. But this is yet another thing that these young people and all of us really have to worry about, is that those, you know, as we get closer to Omnicore, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That those positions go by the wayside because you had five companies and now it's all tidy into one building.
Yeah. I mean, and as Judith mentioned to me earlier, like, this is clearly probably a violation of antitrust in terms of market concentration and being able to dominate markets, which means higher prices for consumers, lower quality options for consumers. We all know the downsides of monopoly, but does anybody think that the Federal Trade Commission is going to enforce antitrust policy in a fair way on cases like this? Of course not. Of course not. So, you know, yeah, getting closer to Omnicore.
Yay.
Yeah.
Public radio is always here for you, WAMC.org. We will take a break. When we come back, we will finish up. We'll have, we've got a half hour with these wonderful folks. And we'll wind our way through a few more stories and, of course, tap into your thoughts on them. You can share them with us by going to panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We would love to hear from you. We will continue our conversation after this news break from the BBC.
Tell you what it was, I couldn't tell you the name of the beast, but I know that it knows that I know. I remember staring at the clouds once from the window of a plane.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. A delightful group of individuals assembled, and we welcome you as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. All right, let's go back to the news at hand. If we haven't depressed you enough, get ready. There's more. The president of the United States is returning us to gasoline as a fuel of choice for cars, gutting Biden's climate policy. This is the this is the story that we'll get you to. This is a story in the New York Times this morning, and this week the president threw the weight of the federal government behind vehicles that burn gasoline rather than electric cars, gutting one of the country's most significant efforts to address climate change and thrusting the automobile industry into greater uncertainty. Flanked by executives from major automakers in the Oval Office, Mr. Trump and the Transportation Department would significantly weaken fuel efficiency requirements for tens of millions of new cars and light trucks. The administration claimed the changes would save Americans $109 billion over 5 years and shave off $1,000 off the average cost of a new car. Just a quick yes or no question, Judith, but are those numbers accurate?
I don't think so, and it doesn't factor in what you pay for gasoline.
The Biden administration's stricter efficiency standards were designed to get more Americans to go electric, but Mr. Trump said they forced automakers to build cars using expensive technologies that drove up costs, drove up prices, and made the car much worse. This is a green new scam, and people were paying too much for a car that didn't work as well. Remember the Tesla demonstration on the front lawn of the White House?
Remember
that? That was not that long ago. That was like in the old public radio or in the old commercial radio days when I was just starting out in the 80s. We called that a remote. We would go and the car dealers mm-hmm. would tell us about the brand new car that was coming on the market that you had to have. And that's what that was. But forget all that. For the past century, the half century, the efficiency standards have compelled automakers to increase the distance their vehicles can travel on a gallon of gas, reducing fuel consumption and leading to innovations like electric and hybrid cars. Judith, thanks.
This is so terrible, and it's part of a pattern of the Trump administration promoting fossil fuels and ignoring the really serious threat of climate change. Their policy is not energy independence. They call it energy dominance, and they want to export lots and lots of fossil fuels. So this is a really bad policy for our lungs and our wallets. The history of fuel efficiency standards, and I can hear people walking away now, the history of fuel efficiency standards started in 1975. And at the time, the average mile per gallon gas for your car was 13 miles per gallon. So, like, who would buy a car today that gets 13 miles per gallon? Maybe a handful of MAGA right. people, but not many. So the notion of using federal law to require more efficient cars has been embraced since 1975. And every year it gets better until yesterday. So the current requirements as of 2 days ago, actually, not current, was the goal was to get fuel efficiency up to 50.4 miles per gallon. And what the Trump administration, surrounded by car companies, announced yesterday is they're going to reduce that to 34.5 miles per gallon. So what does that mean? That means we're going to be paying a whole lot more at the pump, and we're going to lose the benefits of cleaner air, less greenhouse gas emissions. Under the Obama regulations at EPA, which I worked on implementing, by 2050, we estimated that we'd be taking about 100, and the air pollution benefits would be equivalent to taking 165 million cars off the road. So the air pollution issues should not be lost here, but also the pocketbook issues cannot be lost here. And remember, this is just one of a number of things. President Biden had tax credits for electric vehicles. Trump got rid of those tax credits. He's not going after companies who are not complying with fuel efficiency standards. And the irony here is that a lot of car companies were already planning to sell more efficient vehicles, whether it was electric vehicles or more efficient cars. As Aaron says, this doesn't like turn on a dime. So it was really interesting. A lot of the car companies stood next to the president because he sits and everyone stands around him. One, Mary Barra, who's the head of General Motors, said they're going to stay the course. Which is good, but she was the only one who said that. And I might also add that this is so out of sync with what is happening with automobiles around the world.
Well, that's okay. I don't want to get you off track, but that's the one thing that I kept on thinking about was there's the industry of what the president wants to do, but then there's also the global market, which, of course, we're such a part of, and that those two don't line up.
No, not at all. Thankfully, other countries are investing not only in electric vehicles, but more on mass transit. I mean, you go to Europe, it is really easy to get around on trains that are affordable. They run on time. You've got cities around the United States that are providing more and more protected bike lanes, more walkable communities, including in suburbs. So Trump is so out of the mainstream on this. And I actually don't think this is to benefit car companies. I think it's to benefit Exxon and Shell, who want to sell more gas. That is the through line, including on the attacks on boats in Venezuela, the deal that Jared Kushner is trying to cut with the Kremlin and Ukraine. A lot, the Wall Street Journal reporting has put a real focus on how Exxon wants to revitalize some gas pipelines through Russia and Eastern Europe. I think the two through lines for me of the Trump administration is burning more fossil fuel, so benefit fossil fuel companies, and then racism. It touches almost all of their policies.
There's a paradox here. You can think of it as like the paradox of loyalty, is that when the Trump administration appoints loyalists who will do whatever he or his donors want, competent people are going to sit on moral ground, say like, no, this doesn't make sense. I'm not going to do this. So you get left with an adverse selection of incompetent people who do crappy work. So anybody who thinks about this for 2 seconds realizes...
I want that in a t-shirt. Go ahead.
Yeah. Anybody who thinks about this for 2 seconds realizes, well, if we're going to be more reliant on gas and fuel efficiency standards are going to go down, we're going to be demanding more gasoline. And as the demand for gasoline goes up, so will its price. So how is this going to save consumers money in the long run? Any economist who isn't a Trump loyalist would be like, yeah, that's not going to work. So even if you take his estimates at face value that it's going to save $109 billion over 5 years, that represents 0.1% of the average household's total expenditures over that 5-year period. So everybody can enjoy that 0.1% increase in their or decrease in their spending.
And don't you think the car price is more influenced by tariffs?
Yeah, no, of course. My second point is if he's concerned about making auto ownership cheaper, you can get rid of the tariffs on steel and aluminum and imported car parts. You could subsidize research into more fuel efficient vehicles, but he's doing the opposite. So, it's clear that he is just being used by fossil fuel companies to get their way. And to your point, and I don't want to take us too far off track, but the fact that, you know, Trump is laser focused on Venezuela and their supposed narco-terrorism, you know, he pardoned the former president of Honduras, who was convicted of $500 million worth of cocaine trafficking, begs a question. Well, okay, so he's not serious about cracking down on drug-related offenses. So what's the obsession with Venezuela?
Oil.
Well, if you do a little bit of digging, you find out that Chevron and Shell have enormous economic interests that are just hanging in the balance in Venezuela. And if you can overthrow the Maduro regime and, you know, and then put in place somebody who's going to be more friendly to American oil interests, then boom. So now the military has been co-opted by the fossil fuel industry. It's not just the environment and the economy. Now it's our foreign policy.
And remember, during the campaign, President Trump invited a bunch of oil executives to Mar-a-Lago, the Winter White House, and said to them directly, if you raise me $1 billion in campaign contributions, I will take care of you. And I think they raised close to $1 billion, not exactly $1 billion, but the fossil fuel companies are clearly being taken care of as the climate crisis gets worse, as average consumers spend more at the pump, and as Aaron says, as the military is now involved in energy policy.
Not that the military hasn't been previously involved in energy policy.
Right.
This is just the modern version of it. It's also to remember that gas is subject to wild price swings that are out of any individual country's control. Crude oil is sold on a world market. U.S. energy, the U.S. supply of world oil is a drop in the bucket. We can't influence the world price. Prices go up, prices go down. So if we become more reliant on guess, and again, forget about the environmental issues, just think economics here, that, you know, consumers are like, oh, that's great, gas is cheap. Well, it's cheap today. Is it going to be cheap 2 years from now? Is it going to be cheap 10 years from now? And right. you find yourself into it, backing yourself into a situation that might be extremely difficult to get out of. And then a solution might be China, who's investing mm-hmm. enormous resources. They have the two largest car plants in the world producing low-cost electric vehicles. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're just probably salivating watching Trump do this, yes. thinking, oh my, this is, we couldn't have designed a better policy to promote our electric vehicle industry if we tried.
Yeah. And again, I want to come down back to, I mean, in my career as an environmental protector, a long, sad career, seeing circling the drain in the last year. No, I'm kind of joking. on environmental...
Only kind of joking.
On environmental policy, over time, it always got stronger, right? We learned more about the science. You know, lead is no longer... sold in paint because of lead poisoning from paint. Air pollution standards got tighter. We learned more about PFAS in drinking water. Those regulations were strengthened. And so until recently, over time, the environmental laws and regulations got stronger, not weaker. And think of the fuel efficiency standards established in 1975, consistently getting better. And then yesterday, it takes a turn for the worst. And this is happening in every single environmental regulatory program at the EPA. Less protection for our drinking water, more air pollution. All of that will translate into damage in first and foremost in environmental justice communities. And then for all of us who want to breathe clean air and drink clean water and not have microplastics in our bodies. I mean, this is just a really radical shift in environmental policy that we're all going to pay the price for.
But I wonder on, like, as a layperson listening to this, who drives an electric car and is in that sphere and, like, hear what's going on. I'm curious what you guys say. I feel like this happening, this is at the regulatory level, I don't know that it impacts society at large, because what we see on the ground is we see more electric chargers. We see more of a push, because there's been a push for the past few years towards electric cars. So you hear more of a discussion about either getting a hybrid or electric car. People understand their own pockets. Forget what Trump understands and what Chevron understands and what they want to do. People understand their own pockets. And at the end of the day, they know that plugging in is cheaper than going to the gas tank. They've experienced this before. We've seen gas go up to high numbers. We know what it's like to not be able to afford gas at a certain point. So our lived experience might lend itself to more electric cars. And that might be why General Motors stood up there and said, we're going forward.
Right.
We can actually read these tea leaves, and we don't need Trump to lead us on and make these decisions for us any longer. I feel like that's, well, I know what you're saying, yeah. but I'm just saying on the ground, I'm just speaking.
Yes and no. I mean, you're good today with your electric car, although you probably want faster and more often charging stations,
yes.
and you got to build that infrastructure. But the reason why car companies offered electric cars at relatively more affordable prices than, say, a couple years ago is because of the fuel efficiency requirements in statute. The companies were told, you've got to meet these new numbers. And so they want to keep selling some gas guzzlers, and then they balance it out with electric vehicles, and the price comes down. So they want to still sell a lot of pickup trucks. No argument against pickup trucks, but they're not as fuel efficient as your hybrid or your electric vehicle. And so the market was required to offer these electric vehicles at more attractive prices, building the charging infrastructure. That all is now going in the opposite direction as of yesterday.
Let's take a break. We'll wrap up the show right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable as we wrap up this Friday edition of the Roundtable panel. And we welcome, we just have a few letters. I want to get to those, and then we'll wrap up here. But Marianne says, I was hoping American companies would look to the post-Trump future and keep developing fuel-efficient cars. I'll be abandoning those that have chosen to align themselves with autocracy and a hotter planet forever. After Trump is too late, I'll look into General Motors. Then there is this from Ronan, who says, I'm all for having efficient vehicles, but as a car enthusiast, having rolled back emission requirements resulted in us having more fun cars. A lot of legacy manufacturers have discontinued their performance-oriented drivetrains due to government regulations. And then we...
And good luck with climate change, Ronan.
Yeah, well, I was thinking of an article I read in the Los Angeles Times yesterday that apparently Jay Leno was very upset about, was trying to change mm-hmm. the requirements in the state of California that dealt with trying to get a dispensation for classic vehicles, mm-hmm. and which he lost in that.
Mm-hmm. Wah-wah.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I was sort of.
He's really like standing up for the greater good. No smog problems in LA.
Laura says, which I believe was called the Smogcast, I think is where that story came from. But anyway, Laura says, humans are social. AI progresses the separation of people from each other as we are sold a bill of goods that it makes things quicker, easier, and allows progress like the slow food movement. Having people work with other humans on human time, not computer time, is beneficial even for our health. And that from Laura. We have a few moments. Jack, how optimistic are you for your future as you are a senior and will be entering either graduate school or the work world in not that long?
I'm actually less pessimistic in some ways than I used to be now that I'm kind of seeing where things are at. It's just a few months ago I was nervous where things would be at, but I've had more luck applying for jobs than I did the summer internships from the previous cycle, so I'm optimistic.
Was good.
Was that letter from your mom or dad?
Thankfully.
Don't worry.
Yeah, well, that's good. I'm glad you are. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's good. Now, you're out in just a couple days.
Yeah.
And so would you say you're optimistic?
I wouldn't say optimistic, but I wouldn't, like, it was a very negative, I don't want to say negative session, but almost, you know, pessimistic views today, but I would.
Oh, it is every day.
That's yeah, okay. I would hit the median, you know, like, not good, not great, but okay.
Yeah, and in other words, you see a way forward, you see a way, of working in this, in this economy, in this world, and your place in it.
Yeah, I think it's going to be probably like a rough adjustment couple of years, and then hopefully we'll get through that.
And were you all in high school during COVID?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that has a lot to do. I was talking to one of my colleagues at Bennington College just the other day. The students who are in our classes who were in high school during Obama, very different than the students who were in high school during a Trump administration and also during COVID. I mean, that is a double hit.
Do you feel as a professor, not just these two students, but of many others, that there is a sense of if not optimism, at least a cautious optimism?
You mind if we go until noon?
No,
I'm joking.
I know.
So there are cycles and swings to American politics and American history, and I think we're kind of at one end of the pendulum. The next couple years are going to be rough, particularly for college graduates, because the uncertainty created by this policy, all of these regressive policies, are probably more likely than not going to cause a slowdown, whether the slowdown turns into a recession, TBD. But that could ultimately be the undoing of the Trump administration and the Republicans' grip on Congress. So in some ways, things need to get worse before they can get better. And hopefully for a lot of Trump's base who are probably, if they haven't already, will slowly start realizing that they've been had. they've been conned by one of the greatest con men of the 20th and 21st century. And a lot of the problems he's addressed are important ones. Affordability, even though he called it a hoax, at least it's on the table. Security, globalization, manufacturing, all of these are important. He's just pursuing it the wrong way. So hopefully that by introducing these topics into the political debate, more sensible policies can come out of that. And in that sense, I am more optimistic about not the short term, but the medium and long term.
But when you see the optimism that's displayed just by these two students and by others that we have talked to over the course of the last several weeks, I mean, you have to cheer that on, right?
I mean,
you can't go the opposite and say, okay, well, good luck with that.
Yeah.
I mean, you can.
But, I can.
But you will get rated at the end of this.
These are, you know, really top performing students that come from a really great university that teaches them to be prepared for lots of different changes, a broad skill set and so on. So I value and appreciate their optimism. And I can't dispute that, and I'm thrilled for them. But, you know, you're part of the elite, for lack of a better. I mean, not the Elon Musk elite, not the oligarchy elite, but certainly a privileged class. And that's something that you should be very thankful and fortunate for.
I want to thank Sofia Tagliaferro and Jack Riley for joining us from Siena University this morning. It's been an absolute delight having you in the studio, and I thank you so much for all your hard work and all your hard work in at the university and all your hard work bringing it here to us today. And for you, Sofia, congratulations. Happy graduation.
Thank you.
You get to enjoy it in just a few months. So.
Yeah, thanks.
Best of luck to both of you. Aaron, I thank you from the bottom of my heart for bringing these young people to us. It's wonderful to have them as part of our conversation. Also, thanks to Sienna Freeman Tolbert.
You're welcome.
Have a great Yeah, you're welcome. Well, I was going to say, will I see you before the holiday? Are you in again?
Not until the 30th. I'll be here on the 30th.
Okay. All right. Excellent. Judah Thank has a brand new book out. It's called The Problem with Plastic. Get it for everybody on your shopping list. Everyone that you know who listens to WAMC will want this book.
Thank you, Joe.
I'm not allowed to do a call for action, so let me retrace that and say, if you are interested, please find out more about Judah's book.
The Problem with Plastic. Published by the New Press. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll be back right after this.